Hello and welcome to The Bunker, your morning shot of news and current affairs. It's Monday, so it's start your week. I'm Andrew Harrison, up early with your very rough guide to the events of the next 7 days, insofar as we know them so far. Big shout out to everybody who's signed up recently as a Patreon supporter. Our numbers are on the way up, which is very handy because podcast advertising is getting thinner on the ground lately. See the link in the show notes to sign up to support us. We need your help to keep the lights on and also to bring you splendid experts like Oh God, What Now? Regular and author of The Future of Trust, Ros Taylor. Good morning, Ros.
Hello, Andrew.
So let's get into it. This weekend marks the 6th month anniversary of the Gaza War, which is increasingly looking like a stalemate. Israel has withdrawn troops from southern Gaza. Ceasefire talks are expected to recommence in Cairo this week. The war is now the longest involving Israel since the 1980s. Ros, we keep hearing talk about a potential ceasefire. What are the hopes of this? What's the reality of it?
I don't think they're very high. Things do not seem to be improving. Sure, there are talks coming up this week, but to be honest, there are talks most of the time. What we're seeing at the moment is, as you say, Israel pulling out of Khan Yunis. But that is really, it says, prepare for an assault on Rafah, despite the fact that the US has warned that if Israel does attack Rafah, it somehow has to protect the lives of 1.5 million Palestinians who have sought refuge there. So if Benjamin Netanyahu does go ahead with going into Rafah, then it will be a clear sign that there is no ceasefire imminent. The real problem here is Mr. Netanyahu himself. He is increasingly unpopular with Israelis, especially those, of course, pretty much all Israelis who want the remaining hostages to come home. He has a lot of dissent going on, but he is essentially using the fact of the war as a reason to postpone elections. So there's a lot of discontent in Israel about him at the moment. And although Joe Biden does seem to have had some leverage over him with some promises of getting more humanitarian aid into Gaza, it's not enough to stop the killing.
Over the weekend, David Cameron said that Britain's support for Israel is not unconditional. Is Israel losing the support of the UK and, as you mentioned, more importantly, the US?
Yes and no. Cameron has been quite hard line on this. Oliver Dowden, of course, has not. And he was on the networks yesterday, basically saying that we really should stand by Israel. And there's a bit of a divide opening up between the two of them. Of course, Britain itself can't exert much pressure alone. We could halt arms sales to Israel, but that would be largely symbolic since there aren't really that many of them compared to the number that the US send. Cameron himself is apparently going for another push this week. He's heading off to Washington. He's going to meet Antony Blinken there, and he's going to try again to push for some sort of deal, but it's not looking, I have to say, very hopeful. The other thing that emerged over the weekend is a poll saying that 50% of British Muslims sympathise with Hamas, which is, of course, a designated terrorist organisation. And this has caused some consternation in political circles because, you know, when you have half of British Muslims supporting Hamas, it's a sign of just how little sympathy there is for Israel and what it's doing.
On to Ukraine, where things seem to be taking a turn for the worse. President Zelensky has warned that he is running out of ammunition and that Kiev will lose the war if the US Congress does not approve military aid. That aid has been snarled up for months by Republican machinations. This weekend, the Zaporizhzhia nuclear plant has been hit by drones again. Meanwhile, part of Trump's presidential campaign continues to be a promise that he will somehow end the war within 24 hours of being elected. There is sort of talk of peace talks. Are we going to have to get used to this as a euphemism for giving Putin what he wants?
I think we are. I think what we're seeing here is a slow creep towards giving up some Ukrainian territory to Russia in some form. Though, of course, those talks have not begun. And President Zelensky this week is calling for a peace summit in Switzerland, to which Russia would not be invited. The Finnish president, Alex Stubb, commented on that over the weekend and said that that could be a prelude to some sort of talks that would lead to some kind of compromises. And Jens Stoltenberg, the head of NATO, was also speaking over the weekend, and he suggested that Ukraine might have to decide on some kind of compromise too. However, there are other things going on as well. Stoltenberg also said that there would be a long-term NATO funding deal for or by NATO allies by July. And there's also stuff going on, which isn't getting reported in the UK, in Brussels. Basically, this is very important for Ukraine. It's not about weapons, it's about agriculture. The EU already agreed a deal to cap Ukrainian agricultural exports because Poland and France in particular were very unhappy about the amount of Ukrainian food coming onto their market. And now they want to go even further. And of course, that's going to make it even harder for Ukraine to support itself.
It does seem a very strange decision to make at a time when the resilience of Ukraine's economy is so important, to start effectively capping its agricultural exports purely for domestic reasons.
Yes, there are those people, but the more imminent threat is the European parliamentary elections coming up in June. There is a significant threat from the far right on those, and the farmers in various different parts of the EU, especially France and Brussels, have already over the past few months, and Germany, shown how angry they are at their declining standards of living and the trouble that they're having competing with Ukrainian and other imports. So that lobby has always been really important to the European Union, and it is still important. And essentially, these countries have to keep their farmers happy, because if they don't, these guys basically just block the motorways and the economy stops. It's an extremely difficult balancing act, but ultimately it seems that the farmers are winning out.
Meanwhile, in Slovakia, Ukraine's neighbour, the Russia-friendly populist Peter Pellegrini has just been elected president. He's an ally of the pro-Putin Prime Minister Robert Fico, who's called for an end to Western military support for Ukraine, an immediate ceasefire and peace talks with Moscow. What does Slovakia turning unfriendly mean for Ukraine?
This is more bad news for Ukraine. If you look at a map of Europe and you look down the countries on the Eastern Front, I suppose it has bad memories, but I suppose we could say we've got Hungary, which is pro-Russia now. We've got Slovakia, which is pro-Russia, and other countries too in the region which are leaning towards it. And this is worrying because it basically means that all major arms of government are in the hands of the populists in Slovakia. And there had been plans to abolish the state broadcaster in Slovakia and replace it with a government-friendly outfit. Those were dropped. Now that Pellegrini is in charge, it looks like they will be back on the table again. It's very much the Viktor Orban playbook that they're following. And the more that Russia can effectively pick off supporters of Ukraine, especially in Eastern and Central Europe, the less likely it is, as we were just saying, that the EU will be able to hold the line and ensure that Ukraine can continue to fight.
Back home, one of the stories that is likely to build over the next week is, will Thames Water be broken up over its £15 billion debt mountain? Could it be nationalised? Could it even collapse? Thames Water's parent company, Kemble, which is owned by some of the biggest pension and sovereign wealth funds in the world, defaulted on interest payments on a £400 million loan last week. Kemble was supposed to invest £3 billion in Thames Water, but it is now effectively insolvent. Ros, how did Thames get into such a bad way? Its previous owners, Macquarie, the Australian investment bank, took out nearly £3 billion in dividends and tripled its debts when it owned it between 2006 and 2017.
Yeah, Macquarie got a very good deal out of this, basically. The trouble was that it completely screwed over Thames Water's customers, and ultimately, it may well be, the taxpayer as well. Macquarie set up an incredibly complicated debt structure, which I won't even try to explain on this podcast. It involves debt being hived off and guaranteed by various different bodies. And what it essentially means is now the company is heavily, heavily indebted, and no one wants to put in more money because, you know, it's already in so much debt, and it already needs so much investment in infrastructure for the reasons that we all know about. Climate change, huge amounts of runoff as a result into rivers, which are polluting, including the Thames, more customers, more demand, an antiquated set of sewers built by Basil Getty back in the 19th century, which are now all require replacing. So it's this company, no one wants it now, and there's a massive standoff between Ofwat, which is the water regulator, which is trying to its credit to get really tough on Thames Water, and Thames Water itself. Now, Thames Water wants bills to go up by 56% by 2030. They've already gone up quite a bit, as I can testify, because mine arrived 2 weeks ago. It wants to continue to be able to pay dividends to its shareholders. Fair enough, in a way. If you've got shareholders, you have to keep them happy, right? And it wants to have lower environmental fines because it says it's just not sustainable to keep paying out the huge fines that it really ought to pay because of the polluting it's doing. So Thames Water is trying to get is trying to obtain all these concessions. Ofwat is trying to get tough. There's a massive standoff.
Could it end up being nationalised like the energy firm Bulb was when it collapsed or even broken up?
Well, if it collapses, it has to be nationalised. I mean, there is no option, right? You've got to have someone providing water and sewerage to millions and millions of people. So the question is whether some kind of deal can be thrashed out, whether someone can be persuaded to inject more private equity into this company. The shareholders refused to do that last week. They had the chance to put in 500 million. They didn't. Ultimately, that's the only recourse. And if it is nationalised, it might well be split up as well.
Water has become a scandal and a standing joke under this government. Sewage filled seas, filthy rivers. What's it going to look like if the government has to bail out yet another failed privatised company?
It's going to look extremely bad. And it's going to be, it's a long, long-term problem. I mean, this privatisation problem goes back decades. And the other problem, of course, is that the owners of Thames Water are essentially, as you say, a collection of pension funds and infrastructure investors. One pension fund is the University Superannuation Scheme. Part of my pension depends on that. Another one is a Canadian pension fund, the China Investment Corporation, because, you know, we don't just sell our utilities to Britons, we flog them abroad as well, and a subsidiary of the Abu Dhabi Sovereign Wealth Fund. So there have been numerous bad choices made at every stage and a complete failure to recognise how much investment the water utilities needed. And it's not just Thames Water that is facing these problems as well. It's just the most immediate one, but there are other water companies in the UK that may well be in the same position. And don't forget as well that we're facing a similar issue, although the details, of course, are very, very different, with rail. Several of the rail operating companies are essentially in public ownership already. They have no choice about when or how they run trains. Labour says it's going to extend that and bring everything back into private ownership. We've got the ongoing rail strikes. People in the east and southeast today will be aware that ASLEF is striking in those regions as well. And there's also now a threat to the Alstom factory in Derby. Alstom is a rail, basically manufactures trains. It's the last place in Britain that manufactures trains. If it closes down, there will be nowhere else in Britain that can actually make them. And yet it's currently at threat of closure because it just hasn't got enough orders. So we badly need some real direction on this. And of course, the Tory government isn't giving it.
Also in domestic politics, we've got the continuing fallout from the William Ragg honey trap story. The MP admitted leaking colleagues' phone numbers to a person with compromising things on him, whatever that means. Some 13 men, including MPs and political journalists, have received phishing messages from those related numbers. Treasury Minister Gareth Davis told Times Radio, "It's obviously extremely troubling and very serious, but Ragg has not lost the whip." How serious is this, Roz? I mean, lots of Tory right-wingers are calling for him to be punished, even though he's actually leaving Parliament and his career is kind of, winding down anyway.
Yeah, there are some people calling for him to go. There are others who have quite a lot of sympathy for him for the reasons you've just mentioned. And he's clearly been very foolish. But when you come down to it, what has he actually done? He has given away the private phone numbers, WhatsApp numbers of a number of MPs. Well, to be honest, it's not that hard to get hold of the numbers of MPs when you're in the right circles. It's not a capital crime. And compared with the actions of other MPs in this parliament, it's pretty minor. The other thing to bear in mind is we really don't know who's behind this. Oliver Dowden was invited to tell us yesterday about whether Russia or China, some other state, might be behind this honey trap story. But we don't know. We aren't being told. It may well be somebody being mischievous. It may well be much more serious than that. And at this point as well, it seems a bit, it seems to my mind, for all that he was very stupid, it seems a bit pointless to go after RAG. There are more important things going on in British politics.
Yeah, if you're a kind of malicious state actor going after an MP who's already leaving and a government that's falling to pieces in order to gather in intel to shame members of a government who are so already shamed, it just seems to be a lot of work for not a lot of prize, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, another sting, some Lib Dems were targeted at the conference, so I'm not quite sure why they would be targeted.
Over with Labour, we're seeing increasing attacks on Angela Rayner over claims that she dodged a tax on the sale of her former council house. The Sun, Mail on Sunday and Times have all waded in. Roz, what exactly is going on here? And again, is this really serious or is it electoral noise?
Well, the question is whether she should have paid capital gains tax on a house sale, whether she was actually living there or whether she wasn't. And this was all complicated by the fact that she was a single parent at the time with shared custody. So there is clear evidence she was moving between two properties. There isn't a huge amount of money involved, even if she had been liable. But the Daily Mail is making a huge, huge deal out of this, as you would expect. Now, the question is, why is it making such a huge deal out of it? Well, partly it's increasing scrutiny of Labour as it becomes obvious that they're going to form the next government. Partly it's because Angela Rayner is perceived as a bit different from perhaps the rest of the senior leadership team. She's a colourful individual. She's got wide appeal. She's got a great personal story of leaving school at 16, being a single parent, getting back into politics, making a success of herself. So to lose her, because of her popularity with the grassroots and Labour especially, would be quite a blow to Labour. And of course, Starmer so far has very much stood by her. At the same time, he has been very adamant that the new Labour era will be one of very, very high ethical standards and no tolerance for anything that would involve, you know, trying to avoid taxes, still less evade them. So I think they've chosen their target quite carefully. And if they can get her, they will. But I think, I'm not sure that this is really lighting anyone's fires. It was in 2015. As I say, it's not a large amount of money, and it's clear, you know, the motives behind the investigation into it. So I think it may well end fizzling out in the next few days.
Something to keep an eye on for later in the week is that the former chief executive of the Royal Mail, Adam Crozier, and the campaigner, Alan Bates, are going to give evidence over the Post Office Horizon scandal. Crozier ran the post office between 2003 and 2010 and has not given evidence before. Alan Bates will not be played by Toby Jones on the day. And also we're kind of getting ready for Paula Venables, who's going to be questioned for 3 days in May. This feels like it's coming back to a head. Do you think it is?
Not quite. It will certainly be very interesting to see what Crozier has to say. So far, he's kept very quiet. The real person who is in trouble is Paula Venables. Now, she's already given back her CBE. So she's admitted that she hasn't, in effect, that she didn't exactly handle this very well. But Channel 4 and the BBC have come up with more and more evidence in the last few weeks that shows how much the Post Office knew about what was going on and knew that the systems weren't operating properly, but yet they still went ahead and prosecuted sub-postmasters and sub-postmistresses. And when she comes before the inquiry, which will be next month, she is going to really, I think, be in trouble. But in terms of what will change, the important thing would be to speed up payments, compensation, to the people who've been wronged. It's too late for some of them, of course. Some of them have already died. But that is the real priority. But the inquiry itself isn't due to report for a while. And the inquiry hasn't got any teeth. It all depends how much pressure it can put on the government to force things through and to force the Post Office to issue these compensation payments more quickly.
And finally, Airbnbs are completely sold out in a strip across North America, headed from southeast to northwest, because of the eclipse. Some 31 million people are within the 115-mile-wide path of what they call totality, and so are a few bits of the UK, Cornwall, Wales, and I am told that in Liverpool, between 7.55 and 8pm, you will be able to see a bit of the eclipse just before the sun dips over the horizon. There's not going to be another eclipse like this till 2090. Will you be on the roof trying to see a little bit of it, Roz, or we're kind of out of the path, aren't we?
Yeah, we are. We're way out of the path. I don't think it's going to really be registered at all in London. It's a partial eclipse, of course, in as you say, in Cornwall, Wales and Liverpool, but after sunset, which makes it a bit less impressive. 2090, yeah, 2090 is the next complete eclipse in the UK. I'm not sure I'm going to make it that far. I'd certainly be very lucky if I did. So I have to say I'm not that excited about it. I was around for the last total eclipse and it was somewhat underwhelming, but I can see that a lot of people find it very, very compelling. I suppose the great difference, you know, in the past, no one would have had any idea when this was going to happen. And now we know exactly when it's going to happen. It's one of the extraordinary things about modern life.
Yeah, you can book an Airbnb and everything. Certain excitable Americans are saying that with the New York earthquake last week and now the eclipse, it means that Revelations is actually happening. So the world might end and there might not be a Start Your Week next week. So we hope you've enjoyed the last one.
Absolutely.
So thank you for getting up early, Roz Taylor, to take us through the events of the week.
Thank you, Andrew.
And listeners, thank you for listening. Remember, your support on Patreon is the bedrock of what we do here. So if you want to get episodes early and ad-free and help keep the bunker going, search Patreon Bunker Podcast and sign up now, or just go to the link in the show notes. Thanks for listening. If the eclipse doesn't end the world as we know it, we'll see you tomorrow.
Start Your Week from the Bunker was written and presented by Podmasters Group Editor Andrew Harrison with Roz Taylor. The audio producer was me, Jade Bailey, and the managing editor is Jacob Jarvis. With music by Kenny Dickinson and artwork by Jim Parrott, Start Your Week from the Bunker is a Podmasters production.